Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday. This is the day when you and I have the opportunity to meet and explore with another woman the ins and outs of her life, the story that she has agreed to tell. And today's guest is no different. Let me introduce to you Dr. Louise Stanger, who is the author of a memoir of renewal entitled Falling Up. And I'm going to ask her about falling up in just a minute, but let me tell you a little bit more about Dr. Stanger. She is today known as a prominent addiction interventionist. And she, in fact, though, comes to us having been willing to share the stories of her life that were filled with loss and challenge. So the short moral of the story is you can survive no matter what is thrown in front of you. Dr. Louise Stanger, thank you so much for joining us here on Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you. It's a privilege to be with you today, Pamela.
Now, Dr. Stanger, you have experience as a college professor, a researcher, a clinician. You were the director of alcohol and drug services at a university. Clearly, you are an author. You are a speaker. You do so many things. But today, right now, we're going to start with you at the age of 7. Which is where your memoir begins. And you talk about the memory of your father dying, and you were 7 years old.
Yes. The book starts out somewhere in the Crespler Doom, I believe. And really, the first memory I have is, because I do believe that we remember things in nonlinear fashion, was when I was 7 years old, my father died suddenly and unexpectedly. In my version of his death, he was sort of like Superman, and he was taken out by kryptonite. However, when I went onto the third grade playground a few days later after my father died and they pushed me back to school, I was this chubby little freckled-faced little girl. And this really, I will always remember how much I hated Ruthie Ann, because Ruthie Ann, who probably knew no more than I did, came up on the playground and informed me that my father hung himself with a tie.
Oh, that's dreadful. I mean, it almost leaves me with chills as I, you know, think about what that must have felt like for you on the playground.
Well, you know, if I go back there, I was confused. My denial blanket came up. I covered myself, perhaps, in a superwoman cape and just didn't really know, because at 7, that's really a hard concept to comprehend, and was totally confused, because as a young child, you think, if only I had done when a parent dies. Doesn't matter how they die. And then I thought, like, what could I have done differently? Was it my fault because my uncles yelled at me for bad table manners the night before? What had I done? And it was challenging, because in those days, at least at that moment in time, there weren't a lot of professionals around who worked with families, or they worked with little kids about, you know, what does this mean? What does death mean? But I was lucky, and I think that there's a wonderful African-American sociologist. I'm sure, Pamela, you're familiar with him. His name was Andrew Billingsley.
Yes.
And he said, and I'll never forget that, but I didn't learn that till I was a young graduate student, there's always screens of opportunity that come around you to help you through hard times. And my mother, in her non-intentional emotional unavailability, was smart enough to borrow $500 from my cousin, from her cousin Eleanor, and sent me off to a sleepaway camp that summer, where, you being a social worker, you will love this, the person that owned the camp, his name was Leon and Rose Rubenstein. He was a social worker that ran a community center. And in his arms, meaning not literally in his arms, in his wife's arms, I learned how to make a bed. I learned how to do hospital corners. I learned how to shoot archery. I learned how to maybe shoot a rifle, ride a canoe, ride a horse, whatever it was. I have no idea, but it was safe. And I was blessed because he was also the director of the community center where I grew up. And from that day forward, every summer I sought refuge until I was a CIT with him. He later moved to Silver Springs, Maryland, where I paid him a visit shortly before he died.
Interesting. And a CIT, counselor in training?
Yes, a counselor in training. I made it all through the ranks.
There you go. Let me ask you this. When Ruth, her name was Ruthie Ann?
Yes.
When she told you this, how did the, this was in the playground, how did the other children react? Were there other children around?
Do you know, I have no memory.
Interesting.
To be honest, I only remember this loud explosion in my ears. And then I felt really hush, and then I didn't want to go to school anymore. And literally I wanted to, and then I looked at our apartment so strangely, and I thought, oh my God, this is so weird. I don't know. And I started imagining things. And then my mother had the school principal come and talk to me. And also my third grade teacher, Mrs. Riley, came over. But we did something wrong with her dinner. She was, in those days, my mother made a beautiful meatloaf or something with meat for her. She only ate fish because it was Fridays and that was her cultural preference. And so she was grumpy about the meal that was made. So that didn't turn out to be the best of all possible consultations.
Doesn't sound like it would.
I mean,
when you were told that your father hung himself with a tie, did you really understand what that meant? Did anybody talk to you specifically about what you had been told?
No, they didn't. And so I used my imagination. And through the years later on, I obviously sought professional help because you and I are both social workers, and I think one of the gifts that one can give oneself is counseling, and having someone to talk and work that through. And those of you who, I just think that's a gift that you give. But I just carried that sort of with me. I remember cringing whenever I would see a movie or anything, and then I could visualize that.
So it was given to you in a horrific way, and it stayed with you, it sounds like, in a very painful way for a very long time. And in fact, your dad was not the only person in your family who had taken his own life. Your grandparents had as well.
Yes, but I did not learn that till I started to investigate. And actually, as a young graduate student, I don't know when you got your social work degree, but when I got mine, I actually was the youngest person ever to graduate from San Diego State College. I was less than 20. And in those days, it was very fashionable, and they thought it was a great idea to go get analyzed. And so I was actually a training case for someone who was going through the Psychoanalytic Institute in San Diego. And his name was John Hassler. God bless him. Everything that you're not supposed to have trauma when it happens, but that's another part of the story. But he helped me come to grips with sort of that loss. He also let me do some exploration because my mother never talked about everything. Everything was always sort of a secret. And so I was able, that is when I learned about his parents actually both taking their own lives, because none of his brothers, none of his sisters would sort of talk about it. At the time my father did die, they blamed my mother, without even taking a look generationally of, look, there's a history of mental health, there's a history of suicide. And the ironic part is he was 48, and that was the same age of his parents when they committed suicide.
Oh, my. And you said that your mom remarried quickly to Harry, a wonderful alcoholic. That's quite a title.
Yes, well, he was. He was quite, I think that, you know, she also, you have to understand that she was, in her day, you were supposed to remarry. Her father died the summer before I was born. And so that was sort of her normative behavior. And my mother, God bless her, also experienced a substance abuse disorder. And she had been married, I think, several times. She was married once as a young girl. She ran away from home. She married a guy named Silverblatt. Then she married my father, and her family was pretty prominent. They looked at him as somewhat of an inconvenience because he didn't come from a super wealthy family. That was her brother's. And then she, right after looking for love, she met Harry Levine, who was ran liquor during Prohibition, had been married to a famous madam who worked for Polly Adler in New York, and he was absolutely charming and had no social, no visible income save hers.
Interesting. So you really had quite the challenging beginning on a whole lot of levels, even though at the time you were experiencing it, you didn't have the information that you now have.
No, I didn't know what I didn't know. I thought everybody was really strange, Pamela. But when you grow up, and this is one of the areas that I'm an expert in a family beset with substance abuse and mental health, you sort of see things as normative. Like you do become hypervigilant, meaning that you always feel as if you're walking on eggshells, like you don't know if the good mother's going to show up, the angry mother, the mother that's sober, the father that's sober, the drunk one, because when they were under the influence, they had very vitriolic kinds of fights, very loud, and you didn't know which way was coming. You didn't know whether one minute you would have money, no money, and you learned how to live. I'm sure you've done some work with people who they call ACA, adult children of alcoholics.
Absolutely.
And you learn to fly sort of under the radar because you don't know who's showing up.
You described your parents as, and I am now quoting you, having an expansive social life while trauma and trouble always bubbled near the surface.
They did. They partied a lot. But, you know, in retrospect, if I take a look at my mother and through the lens of compassion and forgiveness, she had a very harsh childhood, young adulthood, and not only because she married a gentleman who killed herself, but her mother, that's one of the reasons I always came to your neck, other words, Fanny Swartz, was institutionalized when I was just about 8 at a place called Chestnut Lodge, which I'm sure you might be familiar with.
Absolutely.
In Maryland. And at that time, you know, because I did get the records from Chestnut Lodge, so let me say, but at that time, I was a young little 9-year-old girl who would go to the Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C., like it at Christmas time because it was full of chocolates and food was one of my ways of nurturing myself. But I would be taken to Chestnut Lodge to visit her and not quite understand what the, you know, the expansive lawn, the nurses, and the locked gates. And she would cry and want to come home. And my mother actually really wanted her at home. She had always been the caretaker of my grandmother, who did have fits of melancholy, who was very generous. Today, you'd probably say she was manic depressive or bipolar. And she was permanently institutionalized in Chestnut Lodge. And if you read the transcripts, I think one of the tragedies my mother experienced is she did take her brothers to court so her mother would not be institutionalized. My uncles, both of who deceased, were both lawyers. The one was partners, one was best friends with the judge that presided. One took the psychiatrist to Europe as a holiday. So it's always been suspect, and even when you read the transcripts, she didn't really need to be institutionalized, but that was very convenient for a lot of money. And so if I look back with a compassionate lens, my mother had to experience the institutionalization of her mother, the suicide of her husband. She grew up in a family that thought she was an outlier, not good enough. And I think that she was brought up with that thing. She wasn't good enough, and yet she was deemed to be a caretaker. She numbed herself with alcohol. She could be a very, very mean. She would always say, "Louise, who do you think you are?" And you knew when you heard that, you'd run the other way, because there'd be a litany of swear words that you wouldn't know what to do with. And she married someone who she thought might take her away, be another Prince Charming, but her choices in men weren't that great. And she finally found a little bit of solace, I believe, living in Hawaii, where she eventually died. Nonetheless, she still remained having a substance abuse disorder. To her credit, the goodness about her was she was one hell of a grandmother. She'd weave stories. She was absolutely beautiful as a young woman, and she was so creative. Like, she would design dresses, and she would be able to have an artistic flair, which my grandmother always had. And she had a way in which, and this part about her, I am so grateful that I have. She believed everybody had authenticity. It didn't matter if you were a garbage collector or the head of the PTA. You had goodness in you. And so when she died, her caretaker was a gentleman who was a transvestite, who used to wear her hats, African-American performer who loved her dearly, sang at the local lounges in Hawaii. The people that were her caretakers, someone from who worked at the airlines. I mean, the assortment of people that surrounded as she floated out to sea in Hawaii was one in which you would say this woman loved everybody, and yet she was unloved by herself.
It sounds like such a rich on some levels, maybe that's not the word, maybe complex experience that your mom had, and that you can look at her through, as you say, the lens of compassion, really helps you, I would suggest, with what could have been a lens of anger and despair for much of your life.
I agree, and I think that one of the ways that I look at families, and I'm very grateful that I've learned that lens of compassion, of goodness, because I've learned to give that to the families I work with. Because someone is always more than their substance abuse disorder. Someone's always more than their mental health disorder. People experience these things. But where is their strength? Where is their goodness? Where is that? And if we can find that. Did I have to go through periods where I was really angry, confused? Yes. Did I have to grieve that which I did not get? Yes, most unequivocally. But when you come out on the other side, you always have to look for goodness.
Dr. Stanger, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I was going to ask you about the title of your memoir and got completely caught up in your memoir. So when we come back, I would like to start with the title, again, Falling Up, A Memoir of Renewal, and hear from you as to what that title is actually all about. Folks,
I would love to do that, for you.
That would be great. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk. Do not go away. We will be back in just a moment. Dr. Louise Stanger, author of Falling Up, A Memoir of Renewal. So talk to me about Falling Up.
I thought when I took a look and said I was going to write a memoir, and the reason I did that, let me clarify, so many people have asked me to write how-to books on how to help families, and I just could not do that. And when I took a look at my own life, which I actually did a vision board, but my vision board is in my office, and it's 13 feet long and 6 feet high. It's just a kaleidoscope of photos. And I took a look at that, and I really thought to myself, and I ended up writing, sometimes I wonder, is life a series of falling ups, dotted Swiss cheese holes of stability followed by a series of falling downs, a maneuver perfected by Humpty Dumpty? And as I marveled over the many lives that I've lived as I now approach my 70th year, I realized that in order to live life, no matter whether it's me or you or the person next door, you have to live life in the arena. You have to be part of it. And in doing that, inevitably, there is going to be times where things are not as good as they could be. There are times when you fall down, and there are times when you're able to rise up, to fall up, to be that man, that woman, that husband, wife, brother, sister, partner that you're meant to be.
That really does help, because as I didn't say, but certainly when I first saw the title, I thought, well, that's interesting. Wonder what she means by falling up. You mentioned a vision board. For those folks who don't know what that is, and yours certainly sounds expansive, tell us what a vision board is and what is the purpose of a vision board.
Well, for me, a vision board can be two different things because I used it in a different way. A vision board is if you took a piece of large cardboard and you said to yourself, in a perfect world, this is what I want to have happen this year. And you're going to cut out, you're going to go to magazines and say, you know, in my case, I want to be an author. I want to be on radio and TV. I want to speak across the country. I'm going to put things, family's important to me. In my case, maybe the more correct term is I did what's called a memoir board or a life board. And I believe that we remember things in non-linear fashion. In fact, I write about that in the preface. And what I did was I took my life, instead of having it buried in photo books, I put photos in no particular order and covered this whole board with what I thought was important. From the time I might have danced in a bunny costume as a little girl to the time when I adopted even my Maasai daughter in Kenya. And in between grandchildren, special events, marriages, etc. So that is what it is.
So it's interesting because you did refer to it as a vision board, but yeah, I think you're right. I think it really sounds like a life board. And what a wonderful way to really look at and think about your life, because so many people, once they take that picture, if they're old enough, it's in a photo album, and you know, nowadays it's on a computer somewhere, and that's it. It's never seen. It's never really looked at and thought about again. So thank you. That's a great idea.
And the cool thing about it is, I would invite you to send you a photo of it. You can always change that. It's not static. So if something comes up or someone grows older or you find that, gee, this is just much more important, you can take something off. You can change it because your vision is always changing.
And that's so important for people to remember, I think. We've been talking about some of the challenging issues for your mom, for your dad. So many times when people hear that somebody has a mental health issue or a diagnosis of some point, no matter what the diagnosis is, but certainly if it's a mental health diagnosis, they begin to see themselves and to be seen as that diagnosis. And that's all. And it is so important to do so much more than that.
Yeah, I'm really clear that when I work with families, the people experience, and I always use the analogies, like people experience heart disease, people experience diabetes, people may experience knee replacement or a broken leg. That is not the sum of their parts. Because some people are so much more than that. And when I help invite people to change, meaning help invite people to go to treatment, we have to look at where the strengths are, where the goodnesses are, not just necessarily some of the things that they've done, why they've been under the influence, which are very, very upsetting.
You talk about inviting people to go into treatment. And early on, I described you as a prominent interventionist. Let's talk about what exactly an intervention is. Again, it's something that so many people hear about, but don't really understand what that means.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, in its simplest form, and you and I as social workers know this, an intervention is merely an invitation to change. And every day, so many people are invited to change. Just stop and think about that for a moment. When someone is experiencing a mental health, a substance abuse, even a chronic pain, physical kind of thing, every day they're invited to do something different. It may be that they are invited by law enforcement in case you had a DUI, in case you wrapped your car around the tree. It may be if you're on a college campus and you did something you weren't supposed to do, public safety is going to invite you to change. It may be tragically that you end up in a hospital in the ER room because you overdosed. Or I remember one woman I worked with, she was 64 years old and she had been in the nursing profession, but she was shooting up. She was using fentanyl patches to the extent that she got a staph infection. And she was invited to change that way. So an intervention, what I do is something called an invitational intervention, and I will not do interventions alone. I work with a very talented team member. We're probably the only PhD lawyer team in the country. But when someone calls me up, a family member will call me up, or maybe a business manager, because I'm out in California, calls me up. Their hearts are hurting, and they've done just about everything they can to try and help someone. They've yelled, they've screamed, they've nagged. They've worried where the person slept last night. They threw away bottles. They threw away drug paraphernalia. They wondered what white plastic bags might be of sugar that are hidden under the beds. They wondered what the strange smells are. They may have gotten calls from the hospital that their loved one overdosed. They may have bailed them out of work, saying, oh, they're not feeling well. They may have picked the children up at school because mommy was on the couch. They've begged, pleaded, and set boundaries, had boundaries go up in smoke, because people don't really call us when they're happy, and they're able, and they don't know what they don't know. And so if someone will call us and they'll say, you know, I'm really worried about Sally, or I'm really worried about John. And we're going to find out why their hearts are hurting. And in my interview process, I don't know, Pamela, if you're familiar with Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot. She's another African-American a qualitative researcher at Harvard, the only endowed chair at Harvard with her name. She wrote The Art and Science of Portraiture, which is a qualitative research methodology. You can read it in Lives and Loss of Liberation or The Art and Science of Portraiture. And what she says is we're co-collaborators when we interview. And I use an interview process that I learned from her to interview people. And I really want to know, what's special about Johnny? What's special about Sally? What's making your heart hurting? And what have you experienced in the last 6 months that really makes your heart hurt. And I learn also, I do with families, which you're probably very familiar with, a family map or genogram, because I want to learn about family history. I want to learn whether there's a history of substance abuse, there's a history of some sort of ism, mental health, if there was sudden death, if there was trauma, if people moved, if people got divorced, if there was a child born with special needs. I mean, even today, I even take a look at digital relationship to digital media, because everybody's so addicted to that. And I really get what we do as well. We will interview people separately, because when we interview people separately, we get the richest portrait we can of their loved one.
Makes sense.
And then we'll figure out what is the best way to intervene. And I always try and treat every client I have as if they were my own family member. And after I do a retrospective biopsychosocial, I'm not related to any treatment center in the country. So I will give three treatment centers, given what I've learned about this person, given what their financial resources are, and I'll connect them with those three. And then I sort of stand back and let them pick that center. And then we will plan a meeting, but by invitation, it means that the person will say to their loved one, "Sally, you know what? We've been having problems for a really, really long time, and we've got to find a solution to the family problem. And we've been working with someone, her name is Dr. Louise, and we're having a meeting tomorrow morning. Louise and her teammate Jeffrey, they will be here, and Aunt Sally will be here, Uncle John, you know, your daughter, your husband, you know, it depends. And if it's a higher profile person, it's going to be the business manager, the personal assistant, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll have a meeting, but it's not like you see on TV. In fact, I write in a book, Interventions Aren't Made for TV, in a textbook. And it's very fluid. People aren't reading from letters. They're speaking from the heart. Sometimes people sit in a circle. Sometimes people don't. But you've got to think about it as, this is actually a living eulogy. This is an opportunity to share from love and concern and also set healthy boundaries. And then the way I work is, I don't walk away after the intervention. In a perfect world, the person says yes. It may happen in an hour. It may happen in 3 weeks. It just really depends. But we will work then with the family on a sort of concierge fashion, with weekly phone calls, with to help keep those boundaries in place, to help them recover, help them get the help they need so they can be the people they need.
There are a few things that you've mentioned that I take note of. You certainly, in talking to the individual, I don't hear you saying, "We're going to have a meeting tomorrow to talk about your problem." I heard you say a family problem, which is, you know, for many people, a really different perspective.
Well, let me say this. We are going to talk about their problem, but this has become a family problem. If you think about it, and again, Pamela, you're a social worker, so it's so exciting to talk to you. One of the things we know is that if you have someone with special needs, you could be born with a child with special needs, people coalesce around that person, and then they begin to act in certain ways. And so we have to, I have a chapter in my book, it's called Nothing Changes Till Something Changes. And the person who's experiencing the substance abuse or mental health disorder, they're going to keep doing what they do. There's no incentive for them to change unless the people around them begin to change.
And that, again, is such a critical part that is so important for, whether it's families or colleagues, it's so important for other people to hear. I want to switch gears a bit and go back to your personal life. You described your mom as being the queen of geographic. She was going here and there and everywhere. And you talked about college and your husband, Alan. These were all parts of your life that were certainly challenging, I think is the gentlest way to describe that. Talk about living with the queen of geographics, and talk about how you met and married husband, Alan, and what that was like for you.
Okay, so you have to put it in the context that this was the 60s, and the normative behavior was you should go to college and get a Mrs. degree, preferably to a doctor. It was also a time when women's lib was starting, so you were supposed to burn your bra, right? And Helen Reddy said, saying, "Women hear me roar." Certainly conflicting ideologies. And so if I start with, well, I'll start with my husband, then I'll backtrack to my mother being the queen of geographics. And so when I went to the University of Pittsburgh, you know, most people are supposed to go away to college, but instead, my mother moved away. She moved to Las Vegas because things got very hot and uncomfortable in Pittsburgh. And when I went to school, I was really confused. I had never lived in a dorm before. I didn't really know. And, you know, that was the thing that was sort of implanted in my head. You're supposed to marry a doctor. So someone in my fixed me up with this very good-looking gentleman who was a dental student. That was close, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
And he, well, I'll never forget our first date. He dressed different. He talked different. You know, I was from Pittsburgh, so the New Yorkers, they came flooding in to Pittsburgh. They thought we were little farmers, honest to God. They came from, and he came from Brooklyn. I didn't know what Brooklyn was or was not. He, like, we went for a ride in a grocery cart. Now, what could be more fun or more exciting? And he was exotic, he was funny, he was good looking, and I had no idea that he was engaged at the time. But nor that he would be unfaithful, but he turns out that he likes having other women on the side. And so we met, we fell in love. I thought that this was going to be a rescue router because actually my mom had left Pittsburgh, which was her home. And the reason she left is when I was a senior in high school, she had borrowed money for my father to open a bar, and it was called Harry's American Bar. And I can't tell you whether this is true or fiction, but it certainly was the myth that he burnt down his bar one cold, cold winter night. And he was drunk, and whatever happened, the bar burnt to ground. And at that time, we didn't have much money. And so they left and moved to Las Vegas, because doesn't everybody do that?
Of course.
I mean, doesn't everybody? And I was pissed. And I was sent to live in a dorm, you know, acting out. I didn't want to go to Vegas, but I didn't have any money. And at the same time, I learned that my mother didn't have any money because there were two other social workers that took me to the Social Security office, and they took me to the VA office. I don't think I write about these things in the book, but that I did that because I had no money. I had no money to live in. I was working at the Iron Kaufman Center, maybe making $60 a month. My tuition was covered, but I went from in-state to out-state by their move, and that was like an astronomical hardship. I had to apply for tuition waivers. And I found out that my mother was getting my Social Security benefits from my father and my VA benefits.
What'd you do with that information?
I was pissed. Nothing. I mean, I just was pissed. I mean, what is an eight, what is a 17-year-old girl do with that? I said, can you send me some money? Because at that point they had lost everything because the bar burnt down. And what I later learned is they were living in Las Vegas at the corner of Maryland Parkway and Desert Inn or something like that, in Leroy Continental Apartments, where Harry was now managing the apartments, riding around in a golf court, golf cart, giving away little sheriff medals to the kids so they wouldn't burglarize the places. So they didn't have
Fascinating.
any money at that time.
Louise, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to pick up right here and hear more about your life. And certainly, we will move into the ways in which you have survived so many, in many ways, horrifying losses throughout your life. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be right back. Dr. Louise Stanger, author of a memoir of renewal entitled Falling Up. Dr. Stanger, as I listen to you talk about your life, I am struck by the number of profound losses you experienced. And certainly that's something that you speak to in your memoir. But I think about the loss of your dad, the loss of your grandparents, which certainly impacted your mom then remarrying, which would be another loss for you, you going to college, and then mom moving away, clearly another loss, finding out that your mother was accessing your money, again, another sense of loss. I mean, it just seems like the losses kept on rolling through your life. Is that what it felt like?
Yes. The good thing is, Pamela, they didn't all happen at once, okay? Because I think I would have been a totally different person. I do believe that I'm very resilient, and one of the things I know from the work I do, you can give me a crisis, and I am fabulous in it. It's almost as if I turn on automatic pilot. I think that the loss of my father got reworked when my son died. At 3 months old.
Talk about that.
Well, my third child was a boy, and of course he was the prince. You have two beautiful daughters, Felicia and Sydney, and you get that son who, you know, everybody wanted. But from the time he was born premature, I kept saying, there's something wrong, there's something wrong. And I would take him from doctor to doctor. His nose was stuffed. Make a long story short, the first time my husband left, he was at a dental conference. Little did I know, he was also having an affair at the time with his assistant. Eric was 3 months old. I put him to bed that night, and all of a sudden the next morning I woke up late. There was utter panic. I ran into his room and he was purple, and I called 911, and then I called my good friends and neighbors, the Luminters, and at that time Marty was head of cardiology at UCSD, and they came running down. And then from there, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the little ones, my children, I always feel for Sydney and Felicia. You know, my heart goes out to them because I was non-intentionally emotionally unavailable to them. And what happens with a SID's death is really awful. You call, police come, and they stand guard, so you're never allowed back in the room until the coroner comes, because by law they want to rule out foul play. So I lived in a house with a sort of terror-like staircase. They were upstairs standing guard until the coroner came. And you don't expect to put a relatively healthy, although I knew there was something wrong, baby to bed, and you wake up, they're dead. And I was blessed again with people who helped me weather that. probably the most important person again was only one person, and in San Diego, the head pathologist, his name was Sidney Saltstein. Well, they said that doctors' wives never get this. If you read the statistics of what happens with Sid's death, you know, it was poor, it was non-economic, it was bullshit, excuse my language, on the radio, but it wasn't true. She had also experienced a SIDS death. So she was the one woman that I spoke to weather that. And then my friends let me be a little crazy. They made sure that my children got food, they got taken care of. They found my husband, who eventually came back.
What do you mean eventually?
They couldn't find him right away.
Oh, that's right. He was busy.
He was busy.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what he was doing. I had, you know, and if I did know, it went out the window into denial blanket. So, that's what happened. And then my friends decided that, well, if you have a private loss, you need a public win. So I lived in a little town of Cardiff by the sea, and they decided that I needed to run for school board. And while I was weathering this grief, I ran for school board. I also became pregnant again with my fourth child, a little girl. And that was a tough pregnancy.
I would
because
think so.
I was scared.
Of course.
I'm so grateful I had Shelby, but she was treated totally different than the other two. I almost didn't put her down. They used to call her Velcro.
Well, you know, I mean, again, when you lose a child, and certainly in that way, there's no telling how a parent is going to respond to that and the potential guilt of that.
Oh, it is awful. And I did a lot of work with the SIDS Fund, you know, with the SIDS group and with that, just helping to change the sort of scenario, because the way it's set up, you cannot help but feel guilty. And to this day, they still don't know what causes Sid's death. Why? Because it's not happened in a hospital. It happens, you know, there. What did I learn from him? What was the goodness that came from him? I guess he was just this really cute, chubby, you'll see, there's a lot of photos in my book. But I learned that you could love, and I learned that you could give love again. And maybe that's the gift. And I also, I guess, in my own mind, believe that, you know, there was something wrong, and that was a gift that happened, although that was the most horrible gift. And I was reminded of the wonderful book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People.
You know, the fact that you kind of knew that there was something that was wrong, absolutely, because it would, you know, in some really sad, heart-wrenching ways, help you to deal with the loss of your child. And by the way, for those who don't know what SIDS is, what exactly does SIDS stand for?
SIDS stands for Sudden Infant Death Syndrome. And that's where, just as I said, you put what you think is a relatively healthy baby to sleep. I mean, now they say put babies on their back, not on their tummy. They might, if they believe that there's some problem, today there are monitors. At the time that he was alive, the doctor specifically said no monitor, he doesn't need it, something goes wrong. And the reason they don't know that much about it is it always happens in a home. And so it's not in a hospital where they could do research, they could see what happens, but they stop breathing. So maybe it's like sleep apnea. I don't know. And if you look today and you Google sudden infant death syndrome, you're going to find that they have as many different theories as they did those many years ago.
As we talk about all the things that you've been through personally and the work that you do professionally, it kind of sends me to one of your chapters, which is entitled Be the Warrior, because quite frankly, how could you not be, given all that you've been through and all that you've survived? And you, in that chapter, you ask the reader to ask themselves a couple of questions that I think can really make the difference in terms of how individuals see and think about themselves. Would you like to, I have it in front of me, but would you like to share the questions that you ask of the reader?
You mean at the very end, or tell me what page you're on, because I have to go grab the book.
Well, you don't have to grab the book. I actually have the questions in front of me.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
What are your fears? Well, you know, you didn't write it last night. And
what are your fears? What are your hopes? You know, in a perfect world, I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and so what are your worries today?
In a perfect world, what would you like to see happen today, given whatever's going on?
Right.
And what are you willing to do, I think, would be the other question. What can we help you do, and how can we support you in doing that?
You, and the questions are all so thoughtful and so thought-provoking. What has happened to make your heart hurt so? And I think just in asking that question, and you've used that phrase several times during our conversation today, it opens up for the individual who's being asked, I think, a different pathway from which to respond. What has happened to make your heart hurt so? What has your loved one done or not done? What have you tried to do? And then you encourage the reader to write these things down, share them with someone who has the capacity to be non-judgmental, and that, you say, is the beginning of recovery. How is that the beginning of recovery?
Well, I think that when it's because you become authentic, vulnerable, and transparent. I think that when you're able to share what your heart is doing, what you've done, you have to take a look also at your behaviors. I do a lot of family workshops across the country at different treatment centers, and family also have to take a look at the part they played in inadvertently, non-intentionally facilitating what was going on. And that we need all to be gentle with our souls. And one of the things, and to take a look at that. And also, I think it's really clear, because I don't want any of the listeners to get confused. Please do not try and talk to someone who's active in an addiction or active acting out with their mental health disorder one-on-one. You will only walk away frustrated, and you will lose. It's always better that when you're speaking with someone, that you speak with someone else, and that you always use I terms, I feel. And most people who've grown up intergenerationally in substance abuse families only know about four feelings: mad, sad, glad. But there are a host of them, and you can always download a feeling chart, which will be really helpful. But yesterday I felt baffled when you were screaming, or yesterday when you picked up Johnny at school and got a ticket for drinking, I felt fear.
All of these ways of putting the I at the beginning of the sentence. And we hear a lot about the value of doing that. And, you know, quite frankly, it can be very difficult to do. But again, what it does is it opens up that person to perhaps going in a different path in their own awareness of what's going on with them, and being able to share with another person in a way that allows them to hear and not be so quick to shut down.
That's correct, because you're approaching it from a non-judgmental fashion. The other thing you can do, and I give away five magic words, someone once taught them to me long ago, if you want the other person to be responsible for their behavior, there are just words that are complete sentences. You don't have to lecture. A mother can say to a son, "No, I'm not giving you any more money." Yes, that's correct. You can no longer have our bank account. Oh?
Interesting.
Really? And whatever. So I won't promise you that people won't get angry when you use those five magic words as complete sentences. What they do is they put the responsibility back on the other person. But you're being very clear in setting a healthy boundary. The other thing that you want to also be careful with, that I'm sure you learned a long time ago, is to watch your its and watch your buts. Because if you speak it is, if you substitute it for I, and when you use a but, I love you, but, it negates the second half of the sentence. So watch your its and your buts.
Right. I don't mean to be upsetting, but, and then no matter what comes after that, you know it's going to be upsetting.
That's right. I love that. You got it right away, Pamela. That's beautiful.
Dr. Louise Stanger, let's have a website for you. You've got so much more to share with folks. What's a website?
My website is www.allaboutinterventions.com. You can sign up. I do blogs all the time. I just had one come out today called Rethinking Family Prints, because I wrote an article for TV Examiner, and Noah Ben Shea, who is a wonderful international bestseller poet.
One of the things that I would just like to close with as our time quickly slips away is a comment that you make towards the end of your book in the chapter entitled Celebration. And you say that you made some fatal mistakes that took you down a thorny path. Let me just read it in total. I had to make some fatal mistakes to take me down a thorny path that's right for me, my path. And then you comment, Richard Branson, Mark Cuban, J.K. Rowling, and even the unstoppable Oprah were all fired. And being fired in and of itself allows you to take a look at where you have been, what you were doing that was counterintuitive to what you thought you were doing, and forces you to recreate yourself, taking the good and learning from the bad. And I think that certainly that's what you have been able to do in our conversation today, certainly in your memoir, Falling Up, and absolutely in your life, in your life's work. You have learned how to take the good from the bad and spread that goodness out, I think, throughout a universe of people who have struggled with all manner of addictions and all manner of family dysfunction. So thank you for the work that you do.
Oh, and thank you, Pamela, for being a voice for so many women and for allowing this conversation to take place. And I think the other message, if I have, is be gentle with your souls. Because we all, when we live in the arena, we're going to do things that are great, we're going to do things that are not so great. And the gift is that we can always keep recreating, we can always be transforming, and we can always keep falling up.
We can always learn. Thank you so much, Dr. Louise Stanger, author of Falling Up, a Memoir of Renewal. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you on a daily basis as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can reach me at 301-654-5286, but the easiest way to connect is Pamela, Pamela, at mindtalk.org. And folks, I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.